Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, helping product managers become product masters. Listen and get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad, your host, and this is your home for product mastery, where product managers become product masters. These are the people and innovators that become leaders in organizations. Check out how to become a product master using my free product mastery roadmap at the same place where you'll find the show notes for this episode, and that's the everydayinnovator.com/128. Now, back in episode 121, I had the pleasure of talking with Richard Banfield, one of three authors of the new book, Product Leadership. And then in episode 125, I spoke with Martin Erickson, who is also a co-author of the book. So it seemed only right that I should make this a true trifecta by interviewing the third co-author, which is Nate Walkinshaw. I was especially eager to do this after Richard told me that Nate is the smartest product person he knows. Definitely high praise. Nate has some firm opinions on product teams and how to structure teams so that they work really well. And you may have seen his thought-provoking post on Mind the Product titled, Agile Died While You Were Doing Your Stand-Up. In our discussion, we touch on some concepts from this post, but most of it is diving deeper into team structures and what that means to product managers. Nate has started successful companies in the medical and fitness markets and has had many product experiences. He more recently became the chief product officer for Pluralsight, the largest providers of online technology learning, where he built a user-centered product team. And then in 2016, his role expanded to chief experience officer, where he now oversees development, content, and product marketing. I hope you enjoy learning more about creating powerful product teams. Nate, thank you so much for joining the Everyday Innovators.
Hey, man. Thanks so much for having me.
You're joining me from Salt Lake City, right?
That's correct. Yep. Here at Pluralsight HQ in Farmington, Utah.
Very nice. It's beautiful up there. I'm in Colorado. I don't think either one of us have it too very bad here.
No way.
Good places to live.
I love both, though. Yeah, I love both those states.
Yep. The monuments up there, what is it, Arches National Park? Love that place, right?
And, yeah. And southern Utah is incredible this time of the year because you got all the runoff. Mm-hmm. So when you hike in all those slot canyons, they are much more impressive than they are kind of at the end of the year. It's really great. For those people that are listening, you guys should definitely get down to southern Utah if you can.
That's a good tip. In my younger days, I used to make it up to Moab and go mountain biking, and haven't done that for a while. I should probably try that again.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about teams, but before we get into teams and that discussion, you have put this great book together, and I've had the pleasure of talking with your two co-authors, Martin Erickson and Richard Banfield, about this product leadership book. This is like the trifecta for me. This is great. Get all three of you guys on the podcast. Can you just give us an update about the book and what's going on?
Yeah. So the book is called Product Leadership. Like you said before, I wrote this with Martin Erickson and Richard. I mean, just to... incredible guys with lots of tenure, lots of experience around, I think, the same philosophical approach. I think that's probably one of the best benefits of writing a book with these two guys. Mm-hmm. Is that the philosophical approach was at least aligned, but from totally different angles. Mm-hmm. So the hope is that you kind of, when you read the book, the point of the book is to see it from three different perspectives. And then really the other piece is that we also kind of dog-fooded what we wrote about, which is we wanted to know what the rest of the world thought about product leadership and innovation and how it applied to them from the practitioner's perspective. And we just didn't think that there's been a lot in that space that people are truly talking about. A lot, you know, product management and the craft has been covered quite a bit, but from the leadership perspective, not so much. And it's really highlighting this moment in time around what's happening around product leadership, and hopefully really lays a nice foundation for the years to come. The book will be out here probably in the next 2 weeks. So by the time this airs, it should be available, right? You know, either through Amazon or O'Reilly. I'm really excited. I'm really excited about the book because I think that it's really going to tease apart some of the real pain points that we felt as product management and product management leaders. And our space has not been really nurtured or cared for so long. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's kind of our coming out party, if you will.
Yeah. There's not a book out there that's clearly on this topic of product leadership.
That's right.
Yeah. Really glad to see that come together. And you guys have a dedicated website for it, which I believe is productleadershipbook.com.
That's correct. Yep.
Great. So that's a good place for listeners to find out more. Obviously, Amazon Product Leadership, but productleadershipbook.com for details on there.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Wonderful contribution. I think you had, 100 interviews with product leaders?
Yeah, 100 interviews. I think under 50, 49 or 50 made it into the book.
Okay.
So you're going to see, I don't know. You guys will be the judge. That's what I think we really like about it is that, you know, it truly is a manifestation of launching a product. We'll find out what people think of the product. And we're cautiously optimistic that we did okay.
That's exciting. And I'm looking forward to not only the benefit of the three of you that wrote it, but all those expert opinions from other leaders in the field too. So
yeah.
Excellent. So let's talk about teams. So you are known for the teams you've put together, the teamwork that you've done, accomplishments with product. And I know you have some thoughts about why teams don't work. So let's start just talking about what the current structure is today, generally used for product teams, and what's wrong with that?
Yeah, I've got a lot to say about teams. That's fair. I think the stage that I really want to set for this is it's not that what isn't working. It's more about the reason why things don't work, and that has a lot to do with the historical relationship to where product management is today versus where it was years ago, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of that organizational design, you know, structure came from the days of old. And that has, nothing's wrong with that, I guess. I really want to be clear about that. I wrote this blog post, right? Agile died while doing your stand-up. And the title was meant to be provocative for a reason. It was meant to be catchy for a reason, because I think systemically, we're really trying to point out some really, really meaningful things to the community that really has never, occurred or been present, for the rest, of the world. And one of those things is the introduction of SaaS. Software as a service has completely changed the nature and the evolution of how a team should be organized. The other thing that's really present for people that's, shifted, the dichotomy of teams is compensation philosophy. And I know that most of the product managers, when I say compensation philosophy, they're shaking their head, because performance-based compensation, right, has been one of the most difficult aspects of product management, specifically around waterfall product management, where, one group of visionaries within the company cascade down requirements to, three different or four different siloed teams, and we all come back with different results. And so it made it really, really difficult to actually build something super meaningful at scale, that had a big impact in the world. There's a lot of products that had a lot of impact in the world, but not a lot of happy customers. And so the metrics that I think about inside of my head as I think about, usability of the product, I think about, billings, of the product, and then I think about happiness. And most of the time, that whole happiness thing, which is, it could be measured in NPS, it could be measured in customer satisfaction, it could be measured a lot of different ways, that just wasn't present. The customer was never involved in the process. And that was just a moment in time, right, on companies learning and evolving and growing through, the technology innovation era. Mm-hmm. Now we're in a much different period of time, and it really is, and it's right now. Right now, we've got to think about re-architecting those teams to be accountable, but to be completely autonomous. We have the tools, we have the languages, we have the frameworks, we have the process to set these teams free from the organizational design or the structure, from a waterfall type environment, and allow them to discover and explore everything that they should need to know to manifest the vision of the company forward. And I think it's just, I really want leaders, whether you're a CIO, a CTO, a CEO, a board, I want them to hear that. I want them to hear, that you've got two different organizations in your business. You've got the creative side, which is product management, user experience design, and engineering. You got machine learning, you've got data science and engineering, you've got psychology. You've got a whole section of your business that's creative, and that the only way they're successful is by shipping something together as a team. And then you've got the other half of the company, which is your go-to-market team. And this isn't, just so you know, this isn't pervasive. This isn't just, you know, an absolute. But your go-to-market team, they function a little bit more, not like athletes, but more like baseball players. And so, you know, they have to hit a quota or quota attainment, and they've got a number. That number is solely put on their shoulders, right? And they need to attain that quota. Whereas our mission as a product organization is much different. Like, we're trying to accomplish an outcome. And an outcome is not shipping some beautiful design. An outcome is shipping something that increases engagement, increases retention and length of stay, and increases happiness. And so, you know, I think, you know, we've got a big opportunity, a really big opportunity to make a shift in that psychology all the way up to the top of the company.
So there's a lot in there, Nate, a lot to decompress with you. And this strikes me kind of like, you know, as you talk through that, you know, the prophet standing in the wilderness trying to set a new direction, right? You know, and rally people around and say, we got to change things, right?
Yeah.
So let's pull apart a few things in this. You mentioned where we kind of are today in terms of the organizational design that got us here. And, you know, when you go off to business school, I teach business classes at university some of the time. You know, what are business schools about? They're really about helping organizations optimize operations, right? And that's what we structure, and managers get rewarded for optimizing what's there, which is a little bit at odds with what we need to get done in terms of a creative team creating a new product. Another thing you mentioned was SaaS and how SaaS is changing how teams need to be organized. I want to pull that apart a little bit more. Tell us about how SaaS is influencing those changes.
Yeah, well, one thing I want to come back to as far as your, you know, the operationally minded.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if I necessarily agree. And the only reason why I might say that is because, you know, if you organize teams the right way, I would probably argue that the operational excellence or the operational efficiency is actually much better than kind of the old way of being. And the reason why is that, like, three really key elements for me. Like, when the employees are driving into work, has the company articulated a really clear vision? Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, the vision for Pluralsight today is, you know, creating progress through technology to lift the human condition. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, and that's, you know, that's unattainable and aspirational. Mm-hmm. But the strategy, the strategy behind that is kind of the how we're going to go do it. And so when people drive into work, are they connected to vision? Mm-hmm. Are they connected to strategy? And do they know how they fit into that strategy to go operate and execute? And if they're given the autonomy or the freedom to go explore the execution of that strategy, velocity increases. So, like, a great example that I always use, like, at Pluralsight, in the last 18 months, we rebuilt native iOS, Android, our desktop application, right? Roku, Chromecast, Apple TV, our offline viewing application. We were a monolithic web app and broke that into 16, you know, bounded contexts or microservices all in 1 year. 61 experiences shipped in 1 year. And it's the way that we organize the teams, the way we set them against their vision and strategy, and then we gave them full autonomy to go build what they want. Mm-hmm. And that's the most effective team that we've built and organized to date. And I think velocity will continue to increase, but it's more about the efficiency or the productivity of each individual contributing member of that team that increases that operational excellence. As far as the second thing that we were trying to unpack is, you know, around SaaS. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the thing that I find really exciting is the feedback loop of the buyer and the user in technology software products. The feedback loop, right? I mean, like, look at waterfall product development and then look at the technology stacks that existed and the way that buyers and users were using them. The feedback loop around those products was much longer, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, for us to get feedback on a hard good, right, took us weeks, sometimes months, and it was pretty laborious to go grab that feedback. Yep. And then as IoT installed software, right, like, through Facebook, Insta, you know, through reviews, a big reviewing platform. I mean, if I ship something crappy, I know about it. And I know about it, like right now. And it's awkward, right? And so the same things happened in SaaS platforms, is that the feedback loop in a SaaS platform today is immediate. Like, if I ship a new experience, like, you know, Pluralsight today, if we change the learner's course experience page today, I will have that feedback in my face within seconds.
Right.
And we'll have it aggregated, especially based off the density of the population. Let's just say we had 300,000 active learners in a day, right? I mean, I will have aggregate feedback that's statistically significant on whether the new launch around our UI, one, made customers happy, two, they used it more or less, right? And three, if it's going to change retention curves around billings. Like, I know that by the end of the day. And that's why I'm saying, like, that is, that's what's happening to us, right? And I don't want to say that, I actually want to correct that. It's not happening to us, is we get to choose if we get to do something about it.
Right.
And so the way that you organize your teams in doing something about that in real time to be effective, to change the experience, to iterate it, and that you can kind of see real time, you know, usability, retention and billings growth and happiness metrics, you know, all at the same pace in which you launch. I think that's what we have to really consider. Hopefully that's helpful.
Yeah, that certainly hits the issue of why SaaS has changed all of this. The ability to get feedback instantly, really. And you're instantly, depending how you roll out your SaaS updates, you may be impacting your entire audience, right? It's not, you know, all of a sudden now things count a whole lot more because you hear when things aren't right.
Exactly right.
Okay, so we could go lots of directions here. The love to dive down more on the team organization, you know, because you're talking about kind of the making that contrast between a traditional siloed kind of organization where we're siloed by functions. The standard product team, that at least the ones we try to encourage, are cross-functional, right? We have our teams that are, you know, product manager sits as part of the team, people coming in from where we need them, from engineering, from UX, from manufacturing, depending on our industry, you know, from development, this cross-functional team, but still typically operating in a siloed sort of organization. And you made a contrast with that, and you talked about these three pillars, these three elements, to really kind of get people moving the same direction. I want to hear you talk more about that.
Yeah. And are you referring to the product management, UX design, and engineering pillars?
You mentioned vision, strategy, and that leading to velocity increases.
Yep.
And just how that pulls teams together to have that vision. And you talked about in terms of company vision, I'm sure it also extends to, you know, what's our product vision here? You know,
oh, man, yeah.
You know, which way are we all rowing together?
It's funny because in my mind, the context that I have of this is that, you know, corporate strategy is your technology strategy. If it's not, the thing that I poke on is like, you really should probably take a deep look at that. Given the time frame and the era that we're in right now, if your technology strategy and your corporate strategy aren't nearly mirroring themselves, I'm not sure how much longer you might be in business.
Right.
Because people will come disrupt you. I always love Des Trainor's talk, right? Like your product is obsolete. He gave this great talk at Mind the Product, and it was fantastic to set the stage on how people should think. Is, you know, the second you release, it's decaying.
Right.
And if you're just thinking about, oh, how do we organize teams so that we don't decay, I'm not sure how that's going to go for those folks. So I will kind of I'll use some, you know, I'll use some sensitive topics, you know, that'll get people to cringe, I think, as they listen. But, you know, some of these sensitive topics that I always like to talk about would be, you know, sprints. And I always like to kind of tease apart like the difference between dual track development, continuous discovery versus, continuous discovery, continuous delivery versus, you know, putting, you know, scrum teams in place with product owners with, you know, shipping or delivering, you know, via a sprint. And it actually can manifest itself in an artifact. If you just go grab, if I were to show you the continuous discovery and delivery chart of just say April, you know, of 2017 here, and then we were to go juxtapose that against somebody who's organized, you know, their delivery into a sprint. And I wish I could, you know, hopefully the listeners can visualize this for me, but you know, let's just say there's two sprint columns in 30 days and, you know, they've got 10 teams and they all release, you know, twice in that 30 day period. And there's just two vertical columns that have 10 deploys. Let's just call it 10 deploys. And the continuous delivery and discovery happened on those 2 days. It makes it really challenging when you're trying to do prototype observation, voice of the customer, You're trying to look at aggregated repeatable feedback in continuous discovery around, you know, innovation, something new, around a plus one, around operational excellence or squashing bugs. When you do those deploys in those 2 days, you know, you find out the very next day how people experience that in that prod release or the day of. Whereas if you look at continuous discovery and continuous delivery, if I were to show you the commit history of kind of our 13 cross-functional co-located teams, like we shipped 428 times in a 30D period. And when we released every single one of those commits, right, they were deeply rooted in user experience design, voice of the customer, prototype observation, iterative design before we ever shipped a line of code. And engineering was involved in every single one of those steps. So they weren't just shipping code. They were actually in the middle of the interview, writing the discussion guide or moderating or note-taking or asking the questions or learning ethnography. And the reason why this is so important, like I just can't highlight this enough, is that user experience design and engineering, there are concepts that are so complementary to each other. And the things that engineers bring to the table, which is when you have sat in a cross-functional co-located team before, and you've got a team of like 4 to 8 developers, what happens is that a developer isn't just writing code. Underneath that code, they're writing logic. And the logic is almost near symmetry to user experience design. Just as a user experience designer is trying to look through the logic of, you know, the path that really surprises and delights the user, you have an engineer doing the same creative style thinking and trying to unlock this really beautiful interface through logic and symmetry in the code base. And so when they're learning and hearing and discovering at the point of innovation, at the point of discovery, I can tell you that the connection to shipping something meaningful is tenable on the teams. Like it's so empowering to watch what happens. And so that's the reason why velocity increases, is because they see customer elation, or they see customer disappointment. They see the happiness or the disengagement of their product right in front of them. And that's just talking about the one single benefit of continuous discovery for an engineering team. That's just one. I mean, we could go on and on the multitude of different tangents on why that team, the nuances, how they build, how they break apart cards, how do they size cards. And that's product management and user experience design, learning how a team, an engineering team works. Like what can they really accomplish and get out in that day? And like right now in a sprint team, those are still in matrix organizations. They still report up into 3 different leaders most of the time. Those are broad sweeping statements. Some of them have tried to use design thinking. Some of them have tried to use lean and then put agile together. No, like, look, just bring the 3 teams together, unify them around a vision and strategy, and say, you guys have the autonomy and the accountability to go solve this problem. And hey, let the company know where it needs to go. And we're totally okay with that changing the vision of the company, because you're in the trenches, taking grenades, listening to what the customers and the users, how they use. Remember, users aren't telling you how to build the thing. They're just showing you how they use the thing. You know, the thing right. is in front of them and they're using it. And that's a real clear distinction. People get real wound up around the axle on, you know, users don't tell you, you know, what you need to invent. Yeah, that's right. It's because you're inventing the thing and you're putting it in front of them. But you can't get over the fact of, you know, they're going to show you how they're going to use it. And that's where the real magic happens. That's where confirmation bias really gets curbed. Mm-hmm. Because once you release something and you watch a user use the thing you built, you either blew it or you didn't. And that has everything to do with how you did qualitative research, everything that you did within your discussion guide. Did you lead the horse to water? You know, all of that stuff. When you find out that you let the user down, that team learns together. Right. And it's really powerful.
And you're making it visible, right? It's transparent. The feedback is near immediate, which is a good principle of, you know, underlying principle of what we're talking about in terms of Scrum and sprint teams, which is what you make visible gets changed.
That's right.
So yeah. Your team structure sounds like it has really been driven from a continuous delivery objective.
Yeah, continuous discovery and delivery. So we have three phases, well, four at the very front half for qualitative research. Okay. So you have, you know, persona development, you have VOC, voice of the customer. The next stage is CPT, customer preference tests, or prototype observation. And the last and final stage is CCT, customer confirmation testing. And that really is the quantitative analysis. So, you know, once you have a high degree of confidence from iterating around your prototypes and you decide to actually code it and release it, you have a data set that sits under the design that gives you a qualitative and a quantitative scoring mechanism as you release it into production. So, and we have release phases, pre-alpha, alpha, beta, and then general release. Mm-hmm. So as those designs get released to a percentage of the user base, which they're randomly opted in, you get a qual and a quant score back, and you know, you know, within 4 to 6 hours, if the team's blown the qualitative research, or if they've just, you know, really crushed it.
Mm-hmm. So this is going to be a whole another interview that we'll have to do at some point to talk about the process here, because there's a lot to more we could tease out on that. To stick with the team theme, and you don't know how much I want to go down the other track with you too, but on the team structure, so this notion of having a intact team that's working together, we're really drawing a contrast here between silo teams that might be just doing UX or just doing development or just doing the VOC customer research, to having an intact team working together. Paint that picture a little bit for us. Are they physically sitting in the same room? How do they, are they interacting? How does this work?
Yeah, it's great. I always get a lot of, the majority of the questions that I get are actually around this one area, around how did you organize people? And then a lot of people will just assume like I don't have their challenges. Like I actually have a lot of people challenge me. Right. Like,
your people are different. Your people are not like other people.
That's right. So like to kind of set the table is, you know, Pluralsight bought, you know, 9 companies over 3 years. 4 of those were content companies, you know, 4 of those were product companies, and then another small little content acquisition on the side. So 4 of those, you know, we had to integrate and migrate meaningful product experiences, you know, like live mentoring, and adaptive skills test engine. I mean, these were not small, you know, tuck-ins. They had a lot of people, they had a lot of users, a lot of technology. The technology stack was completely different. Mm-hmm. And so for, you know, for the people that are listening, it's important to know that, you know, Pluralsight 2.5 or 3 years ago was a monolithic web application, and we changed the architecture of the business and the way that we were designed, one, to adapt to the evolution or the technology change. And, you know, we're a company that likes to acquire, you know, products. And we also like strategic partnerships. We like to do integrations with other people. So, and those teams, just for reference, are, you know, they're all in different states. You know, we have teams in OKC, we have teams in Florida, we have teams in Boston, we have teams in Chicago, San Diego. So, you know, we've got distributed teams. So the principle here, and as it stands today, is remember the ideal, that my preferred ideal situation is cross-functional co-located. You do not stand a team up unless you have product management, user experience design, and engineering actually sitting together, doing the work together every single day. And that, you know, they need to be settled on time zones. I'm not saying, you know, the less ideal situation is remote teams, but again, it has to be cross-functional. Product management, user experience design, engineering, reporting up into one, the same functional leader, not in matrix, and not in a matrix organization. So, you know, I'm the chief experience officer, right? And then technology, content, and product all report up into my organization.
Okay.
Anyway, so, you know, that kind of gives me hopefully that gives you a kind of a clear understanding of how we work. And then most of the teams are aligned around the product line and the persona. So we have 3 different personas. We have learners, we have skills development leaders, which are really like the plan administrators or the buyers of our product. Or they could be a VP of engineering or a tech lead that manages, you know, the learning for, you know, learners attached to plans or accounts. And then we have a huge content delivery network. So we have 1,500 experts, and then you've got a content tooling team internally. So we have a big content division that manages all the content that comes into the platform. We had to build them tools, along with giving an experience to our 1,500 authors, you know, to submit and, you know, get the royalty payments and all of that fun stuff. So yeah, the architecture is complex. The product is pretty scaled. We have distributed teams. I think we're faced with, you know, what I would say the majority of major, you know, companies are faced with every single day. I think it's a really big challenge, and it's not all sunshine and rainbows here, but I think we've definitely removed what I have experienced as the majority of the brain damage that you have around siloed teams. You know, compensation-based philosophy is definitely, you know, like we compensate teams. We don't compensate individuals for performance. And so that really is a huge piece of it. Like we could spend 2 hours talking about compensation philosophy and how that needs to be re-architected as well.
Right. I don't know your structure. I assume you're not employee owned, are you?
We're not.
Okay. When it comes to compensating teams, if you have the opportunity to build an employee owned company, it sure is a driver for how they think about everything that takes place, because every action is now, it's your money, right?
That's right.
Okay. So more things we can unpack there. A key aspect, you draw the distinction between the traditional matrix organization, and this is where we have those different functional silos, and we end up with some inefficiencies just because, you know, if you're that employee, you're accountable to work with your functional manager, and you're accountable to work on the project. And at any given moment in time, one's taking precedence over the other, and you probably don't have control over that, where that precedence is going. Even if it's a remote team, it's still an intact team that is delivering all on those elements you talked about, product, US and UX and engineering.
That's right.
And there must be something just in terms of tools that make this work for you. Like, you know, you said you're jumping on calls with customers in real time. The engineer is sitting there with the UX person building the guide with the customer in that interaction. So are you on a lot of web conference video type tools?
Yep. Yeah. So I kind of have a hierarchy of, you know, kind of what I would call as nice to have. Mm-hmm. I mean, the ideal situation is that, you know, we're designing products. I'd say most of the world is designing the products. This isn't, I'm already going down the rat hole of the biosciences, but the most of the time we're designing a product around someone's life. Mm. So whereas most people, you know, kind of come at their product about forcing a person into their product, we kind of come at it that we have a product and we need to figure out how to fit that into the fabric of someone's daily life. Mm-hmm. And then we also, you know, balance that with, you know, are we a tool in someone's life? Or are we something that just kind of runs alongside of it that's, you know, really nice and convenient for someone to have? And, you know, the goal for us is like, we really believe that we want to become a tool. So we, you know, we believe that in 3 years from now, the majority, 60% of the CTOs and CIOs in the world will use our product as a tool to do their job. So that was one clear distinction that I think is really useful for context. The tools that we actually use as an organization is the best case scenario is to do an immersion visit. Like if you can actually get the entire team on campus, you know, truly observing what occurs for those people, that's the ideal scenario.
Yep.
And to be, you know, to be as non-intrusive as possible. Like you actually just want to break up, not as a beehive going around to these different groups, but you want to break up and be distributed and then just live in the fabric of the company with these people's lives and document, you know, the habits of this individual, you know, and start to design that way.
Yep.
The second thing is that I think, did you want to ask a question?
I just want to underscore that was this opportunity to get on site with the customer in their environment, the entire team, right? This isn't just the person responsible for the voice of the customer work. It's not just maybe someone doing usability. It's the entire team to appreciate what that customer's situation is, what they're dealing with. And that just changes, you know, the engineering folks that are making the solution real, that changes how they think about it too. And that's just golden. And you would appreciate this. A few weeks ago, I had the opportunity to talk with the chief innovation officer at Snap-on, the professional tool company. And one of his things, he is out 4 days a week with product teams and customers. 4 days a week, he does customer visits, and his purpose is to get his product teams, you know, from across, you know, wherever they are across the U.S., out with customers because he wants that interaction with them, right?
Hallelujah. I mean, this is, you know, with the kind of the blog post that I'd written is around the Agile Guide was, you know, over an 18 or 20 month period, you know, 400 customer visits. Yep. Like you really get a sense for what's present for people. Like you actually know, you just know what's happening. Mm-hmm. So the more, and I always go back, you know, CEOs, this entire C-level team needs to be in front of the customer, not just doing, you know, C-level things, right. You know, which is just talking to the most important adjacent C-level executive. It's all about step down immersion visits, like get right into the heart of it and actually figure out how things are actually working. You'd be amazed at the connections that happen for, you know, for the rest of the business. I mean, a business really moves pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. when they have that experience. So the other aspect of, you know, tools, you know, the rule around the tool is if we do a video, you know, prototype observation session, or we do a voice of customer session, the rule of thumb is that if you don't have the key people in the room, product management, UX design and engineering, we cancel the interview. So those people all have to be present, mm-hmm. else we don't do it. That's one thing. The second thing is that we've really tried is that if teams are actually struggling with confirmation bias and they're having a hard time getting their experiences out to production, and they kind of keep leading the horse to water, mm-hmm. a really, really great opportunity to push the teams is we'll do what's called double blind qualitative interviews. And essentially the product team, and I'll just use like an adaptive, like we have an adaptive skills engine team. That's a Boston team. you know, as an example, is they'll build a discussion guide for like for our skills development leader on a report for aggregated skill scores. Okay. And if they find out that through VOC and CPT, they're kind of giving confirmation bias on what they really want in the report, one great thing is you can just actually grab an adjacent team like here in Farmington and actually have them do their qualitative interviews. Have them do 10 qualitative interviews on the adaptive skills test engine, and the adaptive skills test team won't do their interview. And so they get to look at how somebody actually responds that doesn't have confirmation bias, that really yields, and then they just get the results back. They can watch the BlueJean interviews. We use BlueJeans for video conferencing, but they get to see all the aggregated feedback on their experience, right? And they didn't do the interview. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, it is really, really useful to see how a team gets back those results. And mostly it's around interview style, right? It's how you led the, you know, the ethnography, mm-hmm. Style, like how people collected, you know, body language. It's really fun to watch the team sit together and watch the interview together and talk about the experience. And I just urge teams to give it a try. It's a really useful exercise.
Yeah, absolutely. All of us get so close to the domain. We think we know what the answers are going to be over time. And it's great when we get someone that can come in and not have those biases involved and learn from that experience. This is excellent. We could keep talking about any number of these topics for a long time. Yeah. Probably safe to say that there's some good information covered in the product leadership book around some of these topics and around teams, and a good place to go next. For the sake of time, I do want to ask you for an innovation quote, because listeners know I love them. I love asking my guests for them. What innovation quote do you have, and share why you chose that one?
Yep. Eric Hoffer quoted, "In a world of change, the learner shall inherit the earth, while the learned shall find themselves perfectly suited for a world that no longer exists." And I think it would, you know, it kind of coins what you and I have covered today, mm-hmm. is that one of my most favorite attributes of a product manager is a learner's mindset. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is. When you approach the problem as if you've never solved it before, and you're eager to learn and understand and relate, that's where the magic happens.
Yep.
It's when you start building, you know, the contextual wall of I understand what's present for this person, is where you don't open up the top of your mind to allow these new ideas to occur to you. And so, you know, the advice to me is, man, like, you know, never stop learning. Always have a learner's mindset. When you sit down and talk to someone that you've known for 10 or 15 years, don't have anything in the way of it. Just be open to what the person has to say. And then the other thing, I just want to say this last part.
Yeah.
Look, the just the sheer nature of our work. Like, think about product management, user experience design, and engineering. Like, this is the soapbox for me, is that if you can't have a learner's mindset and you can't relate with someone and have some contextual inquiry with your own team, what makes you think that you can be this unbelievable product manager to do this for the user? Because you have to be able to relate and open your mind and be willing and humble enough to learn from someone else. And a lot of people put a lot of the things in the way of like, oh, this person is an engineer and they're built this way. Or they have a what we call listening. Like, I actually, when I hear, oh, you're an engineer, I have a listening of you're an engineer, that right. I automatically, you know, kind of carve you off to the side as engineering. Like, we have to stop.
Don't start talking to me about UX. You're an engineer.
Exactly. Exactly. When that just doesn't, that's just not workable. Anyway, yeah, that's a lot of passion behind the quote for sure.
Yeah, the world's always changing. If we're not learning, we're going to get left behind. Excellent. Anything you want to share, listeners, with in terms of your company, in terms of the book coming out?
Yeah, I mean, for those of you guys who haven't checked out Pluralsight, go to pluralsight.com. You know, we are the world's largest developer, IT, ops, and creative library in the world. We truly are closing the technology skills gap. We've got a big vision around the company. You know, by 2020, we want 5 million free active learners on our platform. You know, we have a whole CSR, corporate social responsibility around, you know, making sure that opportunity is equally distributed to people. You know, huge shout out to Aaron Sconard, our founder, for just, you know, his heart and souls in this company. And he's really inspired, you know, me, and he's inspired the rest of the people around the world around technology education. And I'm just, you know, grateful. I always give a shout out to my team, my product management, user experience, and engineering teams. You know, I'd be no one or nothing without the knowledge that they share and give me every day. And I am super thankful for their mentorship and for me, you know, giving me the opportunity to lead, you know, this section of the business. I'm just grateful, super grateful for them. And thanks to you, man. Like, I really do appreciate you and this interview and, you know, even having a care about wanting to get this, you know, this knowledge for teams out. It's it's just really meaningful to me personally. But, you know, I just think about all the hearts, souls, and minds of these product managers, and I really want to get them out of the conveyor belt hell they're stuck in, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Nate, thanks so much. Appreciate your wisdom and experience, and looking forward to getting my hands on the book that, as listeners are hearing this, is now released, Product Leadership.
Thanks so much, man.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. Please tell other product managers and innovators about this podcast. If you enjoy it, they will too. And I make that easy. Just go to the show notes of this episode at theeverydayinnovator.com/128. And at the top of the page, you'll see some buttons for your favorite social media sites. Click on one and just share this post where you wish to. And on that same page, you'll find a summary of the discussion with Nate. And that's at theeverydayinnovator.com/128. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to The Everyday Innovator, which teaches product managers to become product masters. For more resources, please visit our blog at theeverydayinnovator.com.